From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakraborty, and this is On Point. In the 20th century, the giant department chain Sears Roebuck changed how America shopped. Its catalog and home delivery shopping business spread through rural America. Its big stores helped shape suburbia. Children across the country wore clothes and shoes from Sears to school. Its in-house brands, Kenmore and Craftsman, stood for all-American reliability. Well, Sears declared bankruptcy on Monday. The Amazon of its day got Amazon. So this hour on Point, the story of Sears, the American shopper, and the future of retail. And you can join us. Did you grow up leafing through that Sears catalog? Does your kitchen still have a Kenmore dishwasher? How do you feel to see the once glorious Sears in bankruptcy? Or is this just the reality of retail today? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining me first from Washington today is Sarah Halzack, Bloomberg opinion columnist covering the consumer and retail industries. We've got links to her reporting on Sears at onpointradio.org. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, good to be here.
So I want to actually read just the lead from a recent article that you wrote, okay? You begin, quote, "It has felt practically inevitable for years that I'd have to write the following sentence. Sears Holding Corp, once towering force in American malls that was essential in creating the blueprint for the 20th century retail, is preparing to file for bankruptcy." Why did it feel inevitable?
Well, because this was the result of a very, very long, slow decline. And I sort of break it into two parts. Sears, in 2004, a financier named Eddie Lampert orchestrated its merger with Kmart. And that has been a quite disastrous chapter. He's mismanaged the company in a number of ways that I'm sure we can delve into in more detail. And that has played a key role in bringing it to this point of bankruptcy. But long before that, throughout the 90s and the 80s, Sears, the missteps were just piling up that left it not well positioned to compete in today's retail environment.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those missteps, because I think at first blush, people, when they see a major retailer have to declare bankruptcy these days, they think it's because they haven't been able to keep up with online shopping and the major changes in the way Americans are shopping. Is that the case? Or, I mean, it sounds like you're saying that the missteps came long before Amazon came along.
Yes, exactly. So we can rewind to the 1980s when Sears was sort of just coming off of its, what I think of as its imperial period, that post-World War II, through the 70s when it was in, just this really dominant retailer. And in the 80s, I think it had a bit of hubris. And it started to get distracted by adding different lines of business. So it acquired Coldwell Banker. It acquired a finance firm called Dean Witter. Just started taking its eye off the ball of what it knew how to do best, which was to sell people stuff. And then also some pre-internet changes started happening that Sears didn't quite know how to grapple with. And that was mainly in the form of these so-called category killers, these big box paradises like Best Buy, Home Depot, Lowe's, even Staples, these sort of large format stores that specialized in one category. Sears didn't really do a good job of adapting to those concepts, which flourished in the 90s. And that sort of had it already back on its heels by the time the internet shopping wave arrived.
I see. So is this a case of sort of management hubris rather than a fundamental problem with a business model? Like Sears didn't feel like it had to adapt because it was so huge and so iconic in terms of, for much of the 20th century, how Americans shopped.
Yes, I think it had become the default place to shop, and there sort of became this assumption that it would always be that way. And then they did make some attempts to adapt, but they just didn't go well. So, for example, they had this concept called Sears Grand, which was sort of like a hybrid between a department store and a Walmart. So it offered some perishable kind of pantry type goods, but they just started it too late. They realized that that type of format was appealing to people, but they started it too late and they didn't move quickly enough to roll it out. And so it just never clicked with consumers.
Yeah. Well, I actually want to just quickly play an ad, a Sears ad from 1984, kind of giving a sense to how the store sold itself to shoppers. And it was at the heart of many shoppers' lives already. And then this ad features a mother, a father, and a child walking around the Sears, checking out clothes, a video camera, sofas, telephones, all to a lovely 1984 disco beat.
There's more for your life.
Daddy, give him a high. Pull up the seat, pick up a bite.
Come on in and shop.
It's so hard to stop.
There's more for your life. More for your life.
That jingle, I remember it to this day. That's a 1984 Sears ad. Sarah Halzack, in its bankruptcy declaration, though, on Monday, how many stores is Sears of 2018 going to close? How much of a retraction does the bankruptcy mean? I mean, are we talking about the end of Sears as we know it, or perhaps a process to get itself out of bankruptcy?
So they clearly hope it's a process to get itself out of bankruptcy, but I think that looks like a particularly bleak prospect. So let's go through the numbers. At the end of the second quarter, Sears had 866 stores. That's including the Sears concept and the Kmart concept, which it also owns. It had previously said before the bankruptcy filing it was going to close 40-something stores. And then in the bankruptcy filing, they said they were going to close an additional 142 stores. So at the end of this process, it'll be down to 678 stores. And that's quite extraordinary considering that at the end of fiscal year 2011, it had over 4,000 stores.
Wow. Okay. Well, so you mentioned a little bit earlier CEO Eddie Lampert. And, you know, his leadership of Sears and how that may have contributed to where the company finds itself now. So we have a little bit of tape of Eddie Lampert on Monday speaking to employees at headquarters in Sears headquarters in Illinois, taking responsibility, he says, for our mistakes. And he looked back to 2005 when he merged Sears and Kmart, as you had talked about, Sarah Halzack, because he saw a great disruption in retail and with that a great opportunity with the Kmart merger. But things did not work out as he planned, and here's what he said on Monday.
If the world of retail was going to be stable, it would have been much more difficult to create something different. There'd be no Amazon, just a larger Walmart. As we all know, we haven't capitalized on this opportunity the way I would have liked. Instead of growth and investment, we have faced retrenchment and restructuring.
Sarah Halzack, explain to us, what does he mean there that we haven't capitalized on this opportunity the way he would have liked?
So simply put, Sears has really struggled to attract shoppers. Their traffic has been dismal, and it's showed up in their comparable sales growth numbers. And, you know, my diagnosis for that is that Sears has just not been a very appealing retailer to go into in much of the last decade. I don't know if you've been in one of their stores recently, but I've been in a number of them in Maryland and Virginia, and you can just see the signs of decay. You can see wires coming out of the walls, carpets that look like they haven't been cleaned in a really long time, floors that need to be buffed, shelves that are empty. They're just lacking inventory, right? And that is a choice that Eddie Lampert has made. As the company was struggling to deliver a profit and he was trying to cut costs, he made the decision to try to invest in their e-commerce business and not invest in the stores, to sort of let them languish in this condition. And I think the company has paid dearly for that.
Yeah. You know, since you asked me if I have been in a Sears recently, the truth is I haven't, not in a couple of years. But when I was a kid growing up, Sears was the first place we'd shop. We went all the time. We'd drive about 30 miles to get to the closest Sears to where we were. And it was our number one shopping destination. So perhaps, you know, just even in that 30, 40 year time period is the story of the long-term decline of this retailer.
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a millennial, and I remember making my Christmas list in the late 80s and early 90s out of the Sears wish book. That was the Bible from which it all began, right? So I have those fond memories of shopping at Sears as a child. But when I think about my adult life, the occasions I've been in there are only as a reporter, yeah, right? I've only been in there when I've been trying to parse what is going on with this storied company, not as a shopper. And I think that does speak volumes about where the company is today.
Well, I want to play one quick ad here since you mentioned catalogs. Here is a TV ad from 1985 highlighting the new Sears spring catalog, and it says it's not your mother's Sears catalog.
If you think you know Sears catalog, wait till you see this. Sears new spring catalog is hot and cool. Not at all the catalog your mother knew. See what I mean? It's smart, daring, sassy.
Sears new spring catalog is yours for only $4. Get your copy at your Sears store or call our toll-free number.
Smart, daring, and sassy, the 1985 ad for the spring catalog from Sears. I'm speaking this hour with Sarah Halzack. She's a Bloomberg opinion columnist. And joining us now is Vicky Howard. She is a business and cultural historian and a professor at the University of Essex, author of From Main Street to Mall, The Rise and Fall of the American Department Store. And she joins us today from Colchester, England. Vicky Howard, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
So step back in time with us a little bit. I mean, some of the ads we've been hearing have been coming from the 1980s. But in its heyday, how important was Sears? How influential was Sears in how Americans shopped?
Well, I think in terms of its place in the department store industry, you know, it was one of the first true department store chains. And it was a dominant retailer in the suburban shopping mall explosion after World War II. So it anchored all of the new retail developments that sprung up across the country in the 50s and 60s. And so in the middle of the 20th century, it was a very dominant retailer, not just in terms of its catalog, but also in terms of its place in the shopping mall, which became the place to sort of shop after World War II. And earlier, of course, it was it introduced consumer culture to rural areas in the late 19th century and early 20th century, before it was a department store, which it took that form in the mid 1920s. So it really belongs. It has a very important place in American consumer culture.
Yeah. So when we come back from the break, I want to talk more about that, because at the top of the hour, we talked about Sears sort of being the Amazon of its day, being a retail disruptor in terms of how it changed Americans'
right.
shopping habits in the late 19th century and early 20th century, as you just talked about. So let's definitely explore more of that when we come back. We're talking this hour about Sears declaring bankruptcy. It did so on Monday. It was once the largest retailer and one of the largest employers in all of the United States. Do you shop at Sears? Did you shop at Sears? What do you see in its declaring bankruptcy? How much has retail changed? And is this a sign of things to come? I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
You are the first place I always try. 'Cause just like Eve, you have a softer side. Come see the softer side of
1990s ad campaign, The Softer Side of Sears. We're talking this hour about Sears declaring bankruptcy and what it means for retail in America in 2018, that a once dominant, perhaps the dominant retailer in the United States for more than a century, can't hold on and is going into Chapter 11. We're talking this hour with Sarah Halzack. She's a Bloomberg opinion columnist covering the consumer and retail industries. Vicki Howard is also with us. She's a business and cultural historian and a professor at the University of Essex and author of From Main Street to Mall, The Rise and Fall of the American Department Store. And Vicki Howard, before the break, we were talking about how Sears, a century ago, really changed the way Americans shopped, particularly in rural parts of the country. Now, was that because of the catalog?
Oh, yes. I mean, before 1925, it was a huge mail order firm. You know, its competition was Montgomery Ward. It also had a catalog in the late 19th century. This was a way that rural people could access all of the goods that were manufactured in the United States, that were manufactured in northern factories and shipped out on railroad cars, across the country. And you could order your clothes or your equipment for your farm, or everything under the sun was available in these catalogs.
Okay, so the company was founded. I mean, Sears, as we know it, was created in 1893 by Richard Warren Sears and Alva Curtis Roebuck. What was it about them and how they approached business that allowed them to see this opportunity that there were all these untapped customers in rural parts of the country?
Well, I think they started out as selling watches, so it was just a sort of a limited firm in terms of what it had to offer to begin with. But it really grew later when Julius Rosenwald got on board, and he took the company into its sort of modern-day form. So I think that this was the Gilded Age. You know, it was an era of, you know, big gaps between the rich and the poor, but, you know, it was a time of industrialization and also movement into cities. And this growing consumer culture at the time was focused on cities, but, you know, lots of people in the country also wanted access to some of these goods, and this was a way for them to have it. Otherwise, they would have had to, you know, travel long distances to go into cities to shop in the department stores, or maybe they would have just been able to shop in their country store or their general store in their area, in their rural area. So it really was about reaching those segments. And then when it became a department store in the mid-1920s, then it shifted its gears and became more of a Main Street entrepreneur, sort of going into small towns across the country.
Yeah.
And then eventually, you know, moving into this later section after World War II.
Sarah Halzack, isn't this one of the most interesting things about Sears as a major American company, that over the course of several decades, it was able to open up markets and opportunities for consumers in rural areas and, as Vicki Howard is saying, also in suburban areas, becoming the store that had the catalog and was an anchor store in so many malls in America?
Yeah, I think in some ways the story of Sears is the story of the American economy, right? That you can see those clear links from it adapting to a largely still rural and agrarian society to seeing what the automobile would do to change city patterns and shopping patterns and making that adaptation so quickly. I mean, you think about that they didn't start stores till 1925, and I believe within a decade, stores were the majority of their business compared to the catalog. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that it was so nimble, you know, we talk now about the extraordinary changes that Amazon has been able to bring to bear and the speed with which they've been able to disrupt the market. Well, that's pretty speedy disruption, too. And that's why I think Sears occupies such an important place in retailing history and commerce history.
Yeah. So we'll talk more about the effects of online retail a little later in the program. But we've got callers who want to join us because, I mean, most Americans have interacted with the Sears or shopped at a Sears perhaps at least once in their lives. So lots of thoughts and memories here. Let's go to Deborah, who's calling from Watertown, Connecticut. Deborah, you're on the air.
Yes, Megan, great show. I have worked for two great American institutions, Sears and Prudential, and Prudential continues to thrive, and Sears, of course, is not. I started admiring Sears when I was a kid during the Vietnam War. My father was a military surgeon stationed in Japan, so we ordered everything that we needed, and I would pore over it for hours. I think Sears has been ossified and heading for trouble for a long time. I worked for Sears in the 1970s when I was in high school in housewares.
Mm-hmm.
The guy I worked for, whose name was John, man, I hope his kids hear this, he was the top housewares manager in the entire country. He was very innovative, very successful, very aggressive. He was a bear about knowing the merchandise.
Yeah.
He'd send me on spying missions to see what other stores were charging so he could set prices and sales based on that information. He had me cooking chicken and ham inside the store, grilling it, so that the smell would attract customers who might not be thinking about
food. I love this. He sounds like a really creative manager.
He was totally like that, and he never, ever, ever got promoted beyond manager of one department in one store because he didn't have a high school. I mean, he had a high school degree, but nothing beyond that.
Oh.
And you know, and I especially remember just one story that I'd love to share from those days about an old-style manager. Here I was, 16 years old, and I was on the phone with a customer who wanted to order replacement parts for his Weber grill, which was not hard, but he was really, really difficult and really unhappy and hard to help. Well, it turned out that the reason he was so unhappy was that his wife had left him, and she had taken the parts but not the grill.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't handle him, and I finally said to him, "Excuse me, sir, it's not my fault that your wife left you." And I hung up on him. And he called the store manager and demanded that I be fired.
Yeah.
And the store manager, who we never saw on the floor, who was a young man, college educated, wore a suit, came down to, you know, get my head on a platter, and John stuck up for me.
Uh-huh.
He said, "She shouldn't have done it. She's young. It's her first job. She's a good worker. And then he sat me down and he gave me, you know, the customer's always right lecture. But he stuck up for me.
Well, Deborah, thank you so much for your call and for your memories there. And a really wonderful example about perhaps how more qualified people at Sears weren't, at least in this case, weren't getting promoted. Thank you, Deborah. Let's go quickly to Chris, who's calling from State College, Pennsylvania. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, great program. One thing, and not just Sears, but a lot of these big legacy corporations, is the role of the vulture capitalists that come in, you know, the hedge funds that buy these corporations and then leverage them to the hilt to pay themselves back for the purchase price and then strip all the assets, sell them off, you know, like Sears has done with Craftsman and Kenmore and all the brand names they owned. And then once they pocketed all the cash, now they're just going through bankruptcy court to unload the empty shell of the corporation and all the debt on somebody else.
I see. Chris, thank you for your call. Sarah Halzack, did that happen to Sears? Were they purchased by a hedge fund or a private equity business at one time?
So Eddie Lampert, who just stepped down as CEO and who orchestrated its merger with Kmart, he is a hedge fund guy. And he has used a lot of those hedge fund tactics to try to keep Sears afloat in recent years. So, and this is one of the main knocks of his tenure, is that he didn't really have a merchant's instinct. He wasn't running Sears like a retailer. He was running it with sort of his hedge fund guy hat on. And so he was, doing things like spinning off its real estate, providing loans, selling off things like the Craftsman tool brand, sort of moving around financial chess pieces to keep it alive, but he wasn't really making it a better retailer.
Well, so shouldn't we talk more about this then? Because I think the presumption when you hear that a retailer goes into bankruptcy is that somehow they were doing business wrong, but it may have nothing to do with that. I mean, as our caller pointed out, we have so many examples. Toys R Us, he's right, is another one. Hedge funds or private equity managers using these companies as credit cards and then, you know, letting them drown in all that leverage.
Yes, so that's certainly a factor here, and that's been one of the main themes in a lot of retail bankruptcies. You mentioned Toys R Us, but Payless Shoe Source is another private equity-owned firm that had to go to bankruptcy. True Religion is another. This definitely has been a theme that they are, you know, loading these up with all sorts of debt, and that's becoming problematic. But the Sears story is not just that story. It is also about Sears' failings as a retailer, because we were discussing before these stores have just totally fallen into disarray. They're not compelling shopping environments. And that's been a big part of the problem. And, you know, I had one former senior executive tell me what I think is a telling story about Eddie Lampert's merchant's instincts. He at one point was asking why Kmart wasn't selling more large appliances in the store. And this executive said to me, all of our consumer data showed us that most Kmart customers were renters. So why the heck would a renter buy a refrigerator or an oven? You know, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. And so there are just all these examples that Eddie Lampert didn't know how to run this company with a true retailer and merchandiser sensibility.
Because he was a hedge fund manager and not a retail executive.
Sure, but that resulted in Sears not being a compelling shopping environment.
That is fascinating. Okay, I want to bring in one more voice into this conversation here because, you know, we have touched upon a couple of times with you and Vicky as well about how in its heyday, Sears was actually kind of a disruptor itself. And there's a perfect example of that. And Lewis Hyman is going to provide it for us. He's a professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University and author of Temp, How American Work, American Business, and the American Dream Became Temporary. And he has lectured on Sears and its innovations in the 20th century, and he joins us from Ithaca, New York. Lewis Hyman, welcome back to On Point.
A great pleasure. Thank you.
It's great to have you back. Now, you put out this really interesting Twitter thread a couple of days ago about a major disruption that Sears brought to the American marketplace in the Jim Crow era. What did Sears do?
Yeah, so my current book is a lot about race and capitalism in the late 20th century, but I teach, like most people, on lots of different periods. And in the late 19th century, the catalog was a way for rural sharecroppers, especially black rural sharecroppers, who were the majority, most African Americans, most Americans were rural at that point, to get around the strictures of Jim Crow shopping.
And they did that because the catalog came to their homes and they could order and they didn't have to go to stores.
Yeah, you have to understand that for most of sharecroppers and tenant farmers, they were in a monopoly relationship with a local store where they could get all their credit. Like most agricultural farmers, you know, they had to wait for the harvest to come in to pay their debt. So they were reliant on debt and credit. And these shop owners, they would, you know, not let black people have the same things as white people. They would. It was Jim Crow after 1890, and they wanted to make sure that black people knew their place. And so they had to wait in the back of the line. And behind that experience of shopping, of course, was, you know, the omnipresent threat of lynching and violence. And so to have access to a catalog where you could get credit outside of that relationship, away from that white store owner, to have access to a catalog where you could buy the same things as white people in Chicago at very affordable prices, this was a truly radical experience for a lot of African Americans.
Vicki Howard, so did you see that same radical sensibility in Sears with its catalog and African American shoppers?
Well, I'm thinking about the era of the modern civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s, when Sears was, along with other department stores in the South, and also drugstores, were boycotted and part of the sit-in movement. So I agree with Lewis about the potential for black consumers to use the catalog to resist white supremacy. And I think I agree that that happened. But I think it's important to distinguish between what the firm itself was trying to do, and that they were all along fitting into the corporate structures of the time. And in the South, Sears discriminated against African Americans in its department stores.
Uh-huh.
So when it went, as soon as it had stores, and lunch counters and things like that, it was discriminating against African American consumers, as well as hiring white workers, and it was recipient of boycotts, just as were other businesses. So I think from the consumer point of view, I think they could make what they wanted out of these catalogs and use them, but the firm itself shouldn't be held up as, and I don't think that's what Lewis is doing, but I think the firm itself should be remembered for all of the things that it did and didn't do.
Right. So very interesting point, Vicki, reminding us that Sears was absolutely very much a company of its time as well. I mean, Lewis, did you want to respond to that?
Oh, I completely agree. Yeah. I think that, you know, I think Vicki and I would agree on this, and I think most people would, that Sears is a company of its time, and it moved through time. And as it did, it's a very different situation to have a brick and mortar store in a majority white neighborhood, or, you know, trying to appeal to that white shopper, than to have a catalog, which, you know, and you can see the shift. It moves into being middle America rather than, you know, the 1890s, in the aughts, the catalog, you could write to it in Swedish or German or any other language. They were open to come one, come all. So I think it's important to realize that there is not one Sears, but a long story of American retail in America.
So fascinating, because going back to the catalog and how Sears, in that case, reached out to African-American customers, particularly in the South. I mean, you talk about how part of the challenge that black customers had was that general stores, mom-and-pop general stores, were also frequently post offices, and that the general stores were pushing back against Sears and the catalog. What happened there?
Yeah, so, you know, when you come in and you say, I don't have to shop here anymore, and at the same time, I'm going to undermine Jim Crow and white supremacy, there's a pushback from the white store owners and the white community. And so there were bonfires in the streets. There were all kinds of promotional activities to get these catalogs destroyed because they undermined that Jim Crow order. And this wasn't just the catalog, of course. It was other things from Chicago, most famously the African-American newspaper, the Chicago Defender, which was surreptitiously passed from reader to reader in churches or in other kinds of social networks. So it's part of a larger way in which African-Americans were trying to find a way out of this world.
Well, you talk about how that some of the general stores refused to sell stamps to African-American customers who wanted to send their orders back to Sears. And how did Sears respond to that?
Well, Sears tried to enable customers to communicate directly with postmen or to go to other places. And it's complicated when everything is under one control of one place to subvert it. I mean, this is certainly similar to the conversation we're having these days about Amazon and thinking about what it means to have just one store. And this is, of course, Amazon's not part of a Jim Crow order, but it's the same kinds of questions about control bleeding over from the economic into the political, into the social.
Yeah, in your Twitter thread about this, you say that Sears instructed customers to actually evade the postmaster and speak directly to their mail carrier, saying, give the letter directly to them
just
and we'll take care of it.
Just give them the letter and we'll take care of it. Just scribble down the order in any way and we'll get it to you. Get your overalls out the next day. That's right.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, Lewis Hyman, professor at the School of Industrial and Labor Relations at Cornell University. We've got a link to his lecture on the history of Sears and Jim Crow. That link is at onpointradio.org. Always a pleasure to speak with you, Lewis. Thank you so very much.
Real pleasure. Thank you again.
We're talking about Sears declaring bankruptcy on Monday and what that means that this 125-year-old major American retailer has had to go down that route. We're going to get a lot more calls when we come back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about Sears declaring bankruptcy on Monday and what that means for this major American retailer. It's been a retailer at the heart of American life for more than 100 years and what that means for retail as we move forward in the digital age. I mean, let's listen here to a clip from a Sears ad from the 1990s featuring Bob Vila, home improvement television host, also a Sears commercial spokesperson, talking about all the things you can accomplish with Sears products.
Remodeling a kitchen or bath is such a big job. Who can you trust to do it all and do it right? Hi, Bob Vila for Sears, the home improvement professionals. Maybe you've been dreaming about a beautiful new kitchen or updating your bath. Well, if it's too big a job to do yourself, trust the job to Sears. They've been in business for over 100 years.
Bob Vila there in the 1990s vaunting Sears' long history in the retail business. We got comments coming in on our website. Davit says Sears was our parents' and our parents' parents' store. When I think of Sears, I think of Craftsman and Kenmore, the only two brands I ever bought there. They're still manufactured and can be bought elsewhere. So that's a comment from our website, onpointradio.org. Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Buffalo, New York. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing great, Dave. What's your
thoughts? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, you know, as I said, I'm a current Sears employee. I'm a service technician. And you know what? We're just getting bigger and bigger. We're not actually attached to the outlet,
uh-huh.
But Sears is always going to be there. As they explained it to us, if you think of it this way, it's going full circle. Sears was a catalog company. Like, I'm listening to you guys talk, which is very interesting. And, you know, Sears was a catalog company, and then they started having stores more and more everywhere. So then now that the digital age is here, and the millennials buy everything online, just about, and I'm a father of 10 kids, And I've been with Sears over 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's a great place to work. And, I mean, they're going full circle.
So Dave, can I just jump in here for a second? When you mean first full circle, what do you mean by that? Because I see you say you're a service technician, and your business is as busy as ever?
Yes. Okay. Sears. You know what? We're Sears A&E Factory Service.
Uh-huh.
And A&E stands for Appliance and Electronics. Because we do other, Lowe's, Home Depot, Orville's, Best Buy. We do all their service.
I see. Dave,
so as long as all the store, you know, wherever a appliance is sold, we do the warranty service.
Dave, I'm going to take it back from you. Thank you so much for your call. Sarah Halzak, with Bloomberg Opinion columnist, Dave said he's feeling confident, at least for his part of Sears' business, and he sees the company's coming full circle. What do you think?
So I think there's something to the fact that the services area is, if you had to call out some bright spots at Sears, services would be one. That's a key part of their strategy of trying to revitalize the company, of counting on that you trust them for those issues, and so you buy your appliances with them because they have this relationship with you via their services business. So there is something to that. But this idea of them coming full circle, I think they would have to have a more robust e-commerce business for that to be a plausible outcome, and we just don't see them as a formidable competitor in that space. And look, Eddie Lampert's been saying for years that Sears is going to shrink to profitability, and that just hasn't happened. They keep shrinking, they keep closing stores, they keep investing in the e-commerce business, and they've had seven straight years of profit loss.
Okay, so since you mentioned e-commerce, just remind us broadly how much overall of American retail right now is done online. It actually might be less than we think.
That's right. We're at the point now where I believe the most recent figures show 9.5% of all commerce is done online. And certainly it varies a lot by category, right? In categories like grocery, it's probably more around 1% to 2%. In categories like apparel, it's probably more around 20 or 30%.
20 or 30% in apparel. Okay. But overall, less than 10%.
Correct.
And still, and even with 90% of overall shopping done in brick and mortar stores, Sears couldn't capitalize on that or was having problems doing that.
Exactly. And I think that's why, yes, this is definitely a story of Amazon and its disruption, but it's also a story of Sears getting hammered by its traditional retailing counterparts. We mentioned briefly before Home Depot and Lowe's. Those are two extraordinarily well-run retailers that have taken share from Sears. Best Buy's stock is near all-time highs as it has staged a remarkable turnaround. It has taken share from Sears. And on the apparel side of the business, a lot of the disruption there has been from off-price stores like TJ Maxx and Ross, which have been on a tear in recent years and taking share away from traditional department stores like Sears.
Yeah. Well, let's go to John, who's calling from Detroit, Michigan. John, you're on the air.
Thank you. So I bought my first Craftsman set of tools back when I was a teenager in the 70s, and I was a, no pun intended, diehard Sears person. And then when I got involved in the communities of Detroit, I found out that there's actually catalog houses right down the street from me that were built in the 40s that were purchased right out of the catalog. Unfortunately, Sears has kind of waned on the east side of Detroit over the last 20 years, and it's probably been 10 years since I've been in a Sears store because they just don't pull us like they used to.
Yeah. Well, John, thank you for your call. Vicki Howard, you're the business and cultural historian. John, reminding us that there was a time you could buy a house out of a Sears catalog.
Yeah, I think I might have lived in one myself from the 1920s in upstate New York. So I'm familiar with them. They're lovely homes. I think that they had their special a special catalog devoted to them that closed down, I think, right around the 1940s, I believe. But, you can see homes from the turn of the century, 1920s, in any community in the U.S. That you might possibly be able to identify them as a Sears home.
Yeah. Well, so Vicki Howard, a minute ago, Sarah Halzack talked about how in 2018, yes, e-commerce is huge and getting bigger, but we're still doing 90% of our shopping in brick-and-mortar stores. And, I mean, you've written about the rise and fall of the American department store. So why is there this seeming disconnect between how much we shop and where we shop, and why some department stores, Sears among them, are having trouble hanging on?
I mean, we haven't really talked much about Walmart. And, Amazon is sort of taking over our thoughts, as the big competitor for these brick-and-mortar stores. But, when I was writing my book, I thought mostly about Walmart as a competitor for the traditional department store. Sears used to occupy a space that Walmart now does as the largest retailer in the country. Walmart overtook Sears in the early 1990s. So I think that Sears needs to be seen in sort of that longer trajectory that Sarah signaled in her early comments. What happened to Sears is not just about the last few years. It's about sort of a long-term trend going back to the 1980s. And it isn't inevitable. I do believe that that all of those missteps might have made a difference, you know, in the short term of the survival of a firm like Sears. But I do think that if you look at the department store industry as a whole, that that sector has been losing out to the big box stores, to before them, the discounters, you know, Target, Kmart, Walmart, all founded in 1962. And growing through the 1970s, that the traditional department store, of which Sears plays a part, you know, is more of a staple goods, standard wares sort of chain.
Right.
Well, that sector has been losing out.
You know, so I'm hearing over and over again through this hour, Sarah Halzack, that leadership matters, right? Vision and executive practice and where a CEO leads a company really, really matters. But of course, when a company files for bankruptcy or has to retract and shrink to profitability, as you said, the cost of that falls on the backs of employees. I'm seeing here a listener on Twitter, Lisa Hale, saying, can anyone tell us what will happen to the retirement accounts that Sears is responsible for?
Yeah, I don't think we know that yet, but you're right. That's a part of the story we haven't talked about, which is the cost to workers. As of 2006, Sears Holdings had 355,000 employees, and I believe in the bankruptcy filing this week, it was down to 68,000. So already, so many jobs have been lost at the hands of mismanagement at Sears, and we have yet to see how workers are going to fare in this particular bankruptcy proceeding.
Wow. Well, let's get another caller. Lolly is calling from Chestertown, Maryland. Lolly, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I used to work for Sears as an advertising copywriter at their headquarters store in Chicago in the late 60s and early 70s, and there have been comments made about how Sears has always been a staples kind of store, but they really were always trying to go upscale and not successfully so. When I was there, they had consultants such as, I hope I have his name right still in my mind, Trish Baldridge, I think, who was Jackie Kennedy's social secretary, and Vincent Price, who was a big deal actor at that time, who wrote a cookbook for them. Mm. They went into home decorating. I used to do the copywriting for fashion decorating and custom furniture and custom draperies and
Lolly, do you remember like some of the copy that you wrote for those custom draperies and fashion oriented products?
You mean specifically?
Yeah.
Well, I, you know, in my storage boxes of memorabilia, I have all that stuff. And we used to we had decorators and designers, and by the way, a lot of them were not out, but clearly gay, and Sears hired them, which you might think was unusual for that kind of a store. And we would go out and do sets photograph fancy home decor. And what I want to say is it was kind of crazy because people didn't want to buy that at Sears. They had Piranesi etchings. They tried to be upscale, and then I saw that many times through the years.
Yeah.
Someone mentioned how they tried to be very fashion-oriented in the 70s.
And not quite getting it right. Well, Lolly, thank you so much for your call and for your remembrance of Sears in the 1960s. I want to get at least one or two more calls here because they are terrific. Let's go to Mark, who's calling from Waynesboro, Virginia. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I have a happy Sears memory, and that is in 1980 when I was a brand new college graduate. It was before every college student got credit cards in the mail. No one would give me credit, even the bank I used, and Sears was the first that gave me a credit card. So not surprisingly, when I couldn't pay cash, I went to Sears to buy my stuff. They were ahead of that curve.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Sarah Halzack, Sears in the credit business, extending credit to people who couldn't get it anywhere else at the time.
Yeah, Sears was actually an early pioneer in issuing credit many decades before he was in college. And so, yeah, that seems consistent to me with another one of the innovations that they brought to bear and another key tactic they had in attracting customers.
And is it an innovation, though, that got ahead of Sears? I mean, I'm thinking other companies that weren't necessarily in finance to begin with, but expanded into the finance world, and that became more of a burden than a profit center. Did that ever happen to Sears?
I don't think so. To my knowledge, I don't think there was a point where it having its own its retail credit card business was a problem. As we discussed earlier, the fact that it sort of branched away from its core business by having these other kind of financial service oriented businesses was troublesome. But within the retail empire, I think it's been okay.
Mm. Now, Vicki Howard, in the last couple of minutes that we have here, I mean, you're looking at the story through a historical lens, but I wonder when you look forward, what do you see as the story of Sears bankruptcy telling you about what the future of retail might be?
Well, I hope that Dave is right, the caller that worked for the service technician firm is right, and that the firm does go full circle or is able to survive. But I do fear that with these additional closures, it's going to have a terrible impact on workers who at Sears. But also, I think that the shopping malls that depend on these anchors will also suffer. And so, people who are less served by shopping malls and have to rely on these older malls that might have JCPenney, which has also had lots of troubles, or Sears anchoring them, that they will possibly face the closure of their shopping mall and have difficulty finding a place to go shop, and will turn more and more to online.
Yeah.
I think that there's will be some sort of rolling effect of this.
Well, so Sarah Halzack, isn't that interesting? Because, here we are talking about online retail and its growth and Sears' innovation in the early 20th and mid-20th century. But, Amazon, the current major disruptor in retail, they're actually pushing into brick-and-mortar stores now.
Yes, I think we see this convergence where the old guys are trying to learn new tricks and the new guys are trying to learn old tricks. And so I think Amazon, the clearest, splashiest example of this was when it spent $13.4 billion to acquire Whole Foods, effectively a major wager on the fact that people are going to be wanting to buy their groceries in physical stores for a quite long time. But we see other efforts from Amazon in the physical retail space, too. One is their Amazon bookstores. Another is this concept called Amazon Go, which is basically a cashierless convenience store. So the store relies on a web of technology. And if you have the Amazon app on your phone, you can basically just walk in and walk out with your purchase without having to have visited a cash register. So if that is spread more widely, that could be really revolutionary in retail. And they've also just started this concept called Amazon 4-star, where they're having a collection of goods that got 4-star reviews on their website. So they are clearly very eager to be in physical retailing. And I think that's a testament to the fact that this will be a durable model for quite some time.
Well, Sarah Halzack, Bloomberg opinion columnist covering the consumer and retail industries. We've got links to her recent stories about Sears at onpointradio.org. Sarah, it's been such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Magda.
And Vicki Howard, business and cultural historian and a professor at the University of Essex and author of From Main Street to Mall, The Rise and Fall of the American Department Store. Vicki Howard, pleasure to have you as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And last couple of thoughts today go to our listeners. On our website, Mean Girl says Sears missed the digital age just as Kodak did. But Mike L. says, OMG, I'm going to miss Sears. The stuff they sell lasts for years and they'll take it back if it doesn't. Well, go to our website, onpointradio.org, or Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio, and let us know how you think about Sears is declaring bankruptcy. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.